Today's scripture reading comes from Exodus 1, verses 8 through 22. Now a new king arose over Egypt, who did not know Joseph. He said to his people, "Look, the Israelite people are more numerous and more powerful than we. Come, let us deal shrewdly with them, or they will increase and, in the event of war, join our enemies and fight against us and escape from the land." Therefore, they set taskmasters over them to oppress them with forced labor. They built supply cities, Pithom and Ramses, for Pharaoh. But the more they were oppressed, the more they multiplied and spread, so that the Egyptians came to dread the Israelites. The Egyptians became ruthless in imposing tasks on the Israelites and made their lives bitter with hard service in mortar and brick and in every kind of field labor. They were ruthless in all the tasks that they imposed on them. The king of Egypt said to the Hebrew midwives, one of whom was named Shiphrah and the other Puah, "When you act as midwives to the Hebrew women and see them on the birth stool, if it is a boy, kill him. But if it is a girl, she shall live." But the midwives feared God. They did not do as the king of Egypt commanded them, but they let the boys live. So the king of Egypt summoned the midwives and said to them, "Why have you done this and allowed the boys to live?" The midwives said to Pharaoh, "Because the Hebrew women are not like the Egyptian women, for they are vigorous and give birth before the midwife comes to them." So God dealt with the midwives, and the people multiplied and became very strong. And because the midwives feared God, he gave them families. Then Pharaoh commanded all his people, "Every boy that is born to the Hebrews you shall throw into the Nile, but you shall let every girl live." The word of the Lord.
Merrill took a long pull on the bottle before making Daryl's whiskey cokes. She took a quick look around to see if anyone had noticed. Right there, at the end of the bar, Jackie was staring her down, shaking her head slowly. Merrill chopped out three bronchially complex laughs, gave Jackie a big smile, and bowed slightly to her, as if she had known Jackie was watching the whole time, and that she had snuck the drink as a joke to amuse her. Some people would tell the captain if they saw her. Some people had told the captain multiple times in the past. They'd given her a stern sit-down, took an arbitrary number of drinks out of her pay, once even fired her. He was kind of two steps over the line himself that night, though, at the time, and hired her back before the weekend. He didn't have anyone to replace her. In a limping along bar, in the limping along town of Bombay Beach, out in the middle of the California desert, holding on to the edge of the failing Salton Sea, there was not a big employment pool to draw from. Most people around Bombay Beach made money this way or that, or determinedly did nothing at all, seeing how far up to the edge the universe would let them go without falling off it. When folks from outside ask about Bombay, she liked to tell them that the town was made up of people who came out here to disappear, to get off the grid, and people who fell off the grid and are having a hard time getting back on it. She knew Jackie wouldn't say anything. Still, it was embarrassing. Daryl paid for the drink and added a five. "Get yourself one," he said. Now, this was perfectly acceptable. She poured a generous shot and made a big show of taking Daryl's five, waving it in the air as if she were dancing it to the cash register, rang up the drink, put the five in, took out the change, held it up with the other hand, and after a flourish, placed it in the tip jar. "Thank you, honey," she said, Daryl's way, then picked up the drink, walked it down the bar, and set it in front of Jackie. "For you," she said sweetly. It didn't hurt to be sure, she thought. Merrill, you're so kind. Jackie sipped the drink. Tell me this. Have you heard about the super bloom? The super bloom? Yeah, you know, over at Anza Borrego. Oh, yeah, yeah, the desert flowers. Yeah, I know that, but I don't think I ever saw it. No, you wouldn't have. There hasn't been one in more than 20 years because of the drought. Now all that rain we got all winter long, it's been soaking deep into the desert floor. Places where there hasn't been water in a quarter of a century. And they had these seeds that had been down in the ground, buried deep in the depths for some 10 years, some for 25 or 50 years, some even more than 100 years. No. Merrill sounded in disbelief, but clearly caught up in the possibility. Yes, I've been reading all about it. This tourist I met walking down by the ruins at the sea, he was telling me about it. And when I went into Brawley, I got a book at the library, and I used the internet, and I read all about it. Yeah? Yeah. All that desert, as long as you've known it, as long as you looked at it, it was just tan rocks and dirt. And then like that, it's covered with flowers. It's carpeted with flowers. It's blanketed with flowers, yellow and purple and red, and everything, as far as you can see, running right up into the mountains. Look, I got the book. Jackie pulled a hardback coffee table book out of her bag from the floor of the stool beside her. It was a Sunset Magazine publication from the early 1970s called The Miracle in the Desert. She opened up a two-page photo and held it open beside her so Merrill could see, and she read the caption in her librarian style. In the most remarkable and rare blooms, there are desert sunflowers and dune evening primrose, sand verbena, ghost flowers, monkey flowers, and wild Canterbury bells, and the ocotillo and beavertail cactus bloom brightly. That is the prettiest thing, Merrill said, taking the book from Jackie and searching the photo. Can you imagine seeing that in real life? I bet you can hardly breathe. I'd like to see that. This is supposed to be the biggest super bloom in forever because of the extended drought and all the rain all winter long. I read in the LA Times online that people are coming from Europe and Japan and China and from all over the country to see it. Can you believe that? You know what, Jackie, Merrill said? I can believe that. Just because it's so, well, good. It's goodness. Like all around us, all of us who live out here, it's all just one color. It's all just desert color and hot and hard. And we like it out here, some of us more than others. And we choose to be here, well, some of us more than others. But I don't know a person out here who isn't kind of counting on something more to happen, some goodness, something soft and colorful and beautiful. And people all over the world kind of get the idea in them that a desert is going to turn into the biggest, prettiest flower garden overnight. And it gets to them some way. And they want to see it. They don't want to miss something like that, an impossible thing, giving birth to a beautiful thing like that. Well, and there's no telling how long they have to see it, or how long before the caterpillars will eat it up. What? Yeah, get this. Not only are those seeds down there in the ground waiting for the rain to reach them, but they're also the larvae of the sphinx moth. The sphinx moth? Like the Egyptian sphinx? Yeah. Why did they call it that? I don't know, but listen. Underground, the larvae change into adult sphinx moths and dig their way up out of the ground. Moths dig their way out of the ground? Yeah, and they fly around and they lay eggs on the desert flowers. Each moth lays more than 1,000 eggs, and the eggs turn into caterpillars, and the caterpillars eat up the entire super bloom. Really? Sphinx caterpillars eat it all? There are millions and millions of them. One of the stories my father used to tell me, one of them about when we were all slaves in Egypt. Oh, I like the rabbi stories, Merrill said, and poured them both an ice water. Jackie's father was a rabbi, and as a little girl, she was his best student, and even thought she might study to be a rabbi. Then life happened, and she hadn't been in touch with her family in a long time. Whenever it came up out here that her father was a rabbi, people looked at her like she must be joking. She would always shrug off their shock with her standard one-liner. I know, you're thinking, how does a nice Jewish girl end up here? Well, a nice one doesn't. Perfect timing and delivery, it always got a laugh. My father would tell the story about how Joseph brought all the tribe of Israel, the whole Hebrew nation, to Egypt because there was a great drought and nothing would grow. But Joseph was the Pharaoh's most trusted advisor, and the Pharaoh would give him anything he wanted. So Joseph took care of his father and mother and brothers and their wives and children and the whole tribe of Israel, the whole Hebrew nation. And so they stayed there and settled. And many generations later, there was a new Pharaoh who did not like the Hebrew people. He looked around and saw how many there were and how fertile they were. Each Hebrew woman would give birth up to 6 babies at a time. At a time. This is what the rabbis say. And so the Pharaoh made them all slaves and put them to work, to hard labor, making bricks and building the pyramids. I don't think that was the same time. People say that. And the Sphinx? Maybe. Just listen. The Pharaoh thought if he made them work all the time, they would be too tired to, have sex. And that would control the birth rate because he was afraid of this fertility. If it kept up, they would outnumber the Egyptians and take over. But guess what? Nothing could stop the fertile Hebrew people from making babies. He was so bad, he decided since that didn't work, he called the midwives and he said to them, now, when you go to help the Hebrew women and they sit on the birthing stool, if that baby is a boy, you take it and you kill it. But the Hebrew midwives wouldn't do that. No, they went out and they would help to nurture the babies and take care of them so they would grow. And the numbers keep growing and growing and growing. And finally, Pharaoh saw this and he called them back in and he said, how is this that you have not stopped them? Are you not doing as I say? And the midwives told him that they are more clever than the Egyptian women, that they deliver their own babies before they can even come, before they can even come. Now the rabbis, my father would tell me, know that these 2 midwives, even though they were named Shira and Pua, those were their nicknames, for really they were the mother and sister of Moses. And they had, in the same way as they'd done with all these male babies, saved Moses and nurtured him and brought him up. And he came and eventually led his people out of Egypt and freed them. It was this fertility that led to their freedom and their deliverance. Merle thought, well, that is a story. What makes you think of that now? The Sphinx moths? No. My father would say in the Torah, whenever the issue of fertility, barrenness, and fertility comes up, it's about faith and hope. And when God promises Abraham and Sarah that a great nation will come from their offspring, but they are barren into their old age, that's because God needs to show them to show their faith, to be able to continue to hope for this possibility that seems impossible. They're going to need the strength of that hope. And the same with Isaac and Rebecca and Rachel and Jacob. God needs them to show their faith, to be able to continue to hope for this possibility that seems impossible. And then, when our people were slaves in Egypt, and it seemed like God had abandoned God's people. That's when it was God's turn. That's when God gave them this super fertility, because God needed to show them the faith that God had in them, that God could reward their hope, that God would make the impossible possible. All that fertility leads to Moses challenging the Pharaoh and leading the people to freedom. God parted the Red Sea before them so they could escape into the wilderness. "The wilderness?" Merrill said. "Yeah. The desert? Yeah. Do you feel like we've escaped to freedom here?" "Well, maybe it's not a direct correlation. I didn't get through here by the parting of the Salton Sea. I took a bus to Indio and then met this guy at a truck stop." Everyone had long ago left the bar. The two of them had lost track of the time. Merrill looked up at the clock on the wall. "It's going to be light in a couple hours." Jackie looked at her. "Do you want to go see what hope looks like?" "What do you mean?" "Let's go see that super bloom. I'll drive." They got in the car. Jackie started it up and headed in the direction of the Anza Borrego Desert. And Merrill thought, hope. Hope is a radical and fertile thing.